Hello everyone, welcome to Computer Science E7. This is lecture 6, histograms. So just a couple of things before we get started. Last week, as you hopefully know, we were snowed in or out, I suppose, and weren't able to have our normal lecture for optics. And this is pretty important. And unfortunately, being a Monday class, we are already limited in terms of the number of lectures that we have. So we had to make it up with or without you present. And so what we did was we recorded it, just like we do all the other lectures, and put the recording online. So this is the same lecture that would have taken place last week. It's just in video format. So now, if you haven't already, please do go ahead and go to the website and take a look at that lecture video. It comes in a couple of formats, QuickTime format that you can download and put on your iPod using iTunes. Or Flash if you want to just sit there and watch it at your computer. It's just under 2 hours, and it covers a lot of topics that we won't be able to go over in person, but will be very useful for your knowledge of digital photography, but also for assignment 2. It covers a lot of questions and will hopefully alleviate some concerns that you may have. And certainly that's a good segue into assignment 2. Just a quick reminder that it is actually due a week from today. So Monday, next Monday, March 16th at 7:35 p.m. You'll notice that you can actually begin to submit the portions or the different parts of that assignment to the course website. The link is posted on the homepage as well, but it's just at the same place as it was last time for assignment 1, csc7.org/submit, as you can see up here. And you should feel free to, as soon as you start collecting all of the photographs and the various parts for your assignment, you should go there and start uploading that at your earliest convenience. Yes?
Do you know when we'll be getting back to assignment 1?
We're still working on assignment 1. Hopefully we will have it, well, maybe John, you can help me out a little bit, but I'm thinking hopefully the next few days. Yeah, so within the next few days, we should hopefully be able to give them back to you so you can take a look at the comments and be able to incorporate them. Maybe not, since we're running out of time to incorporate comments in assignment 2, but at least for assignment 3. And then we hopefully will be a little bit quicker with assignment 3. We just had some technical hurdles of our own with so many images being uploaded that we had to overcome, and we in fact are still overcoming. And let's see if I can actually go back a couple of lectures. Let's see, so the last time we met wasn't, like I said, it was not for lecture 5, but was for lecture 4, exposure. And I talked a bit about guide number, and remember the guide number is basically, you can think of it essentially as the power of a flash, and it's used in, especially in marketing terms, when manufacturers are showing the power of their flash. It's a useful way for you to be able to tell approximately how powerful it is. And there was a slight, I gave some very slightly misleading information. Some of the math didn't add up properly in this text that I was showing. So if you remember, this was the text that I was showing. I said that the guide number equals the distance that the flash can properly expose a subject times the F number. And I gave a few examples of it and said that, okay, so let's just take a look at this first line here. If I have a guide number of 40 feet at ISO 100, and these guide numbers are usually given at ISO 100, that means that using an F number of F4, we can therefore expose a subject properly 10 feet away. That math is correct. 10 times 4 is 40. There's no problem there. Same thing with the second line, where I said if we remain at ISO 100, where our guide number remains at 40 feet, and if we increase the aperture one stop, so we lower the F number to 2.8, then the guide number, or the distance then, that we could properly expose an object or a subject is 14 feet. So that's also okay. That math also stands to be true. However, where I gave a little bit of a goof is when I talked about the guide number for ISO 200. And that's because remember that if we increase the ISO by one stop, then what that essentially means is that we are also increasing the distance by a certain amount. And so we can take a look and figure out what the guide number would be. And in this case, what was wrong was the guide number at ISO 200. It actually changes slightly. And so if we increase the sensitivity of the sensor by one stop, then that means that also for the same distance, 14 feet, that we could have one F number higher, one stop higher. Well, not the value one, but one stop higher in the F number. And that is the guide number at that particular ISO. And it is this that is the goof, because I said that the guide number remained at 40 feet for ISO 200, but that's not true. It actually, let's see, so if we do 14 times 4, it actually increases to 56 feet. And the only reason for that is because we are increasing the sensitivity of the sensor itself, so the flash, for the same power that is given off by the flash, which is the same power, it doesn't actually increase here, then the light can travel further and be able to expose the photograph the same amount. So hopefully that makes sense. So normally what flash guide numbers will be, or what flash manufacturers will give you the guide number in, is at this ISO 100 measurement. However, realize that when you increase the sensitivity, the light can travel farther, which means that the guide number will also go up for that particular ISO. So if we go up to ISO 200, then the guide number changes to 56 feet. Yes?
How did you get the 56 feet?
So the way I got it was literally just by multiplying 14 feet times F4, or 14 times 4 is 56 feet, because remember the guide number is just equal to the distance times the F number.
Well, I guess that poses a little bit of a problem for me, because I would use this formula to figure out the 14 feet.
Right. So
how would I...
So what I'm showing here, there's different ways that we can use this equation to manipulate the guide number, the distance, and the F number. So the easiest calculation is this top one, where we are provided the guide number from a manufacturer. We know the subject's distance away. Then we can divide 40 by 10 to figure out the F number that is appropriate to expose that that object or that subject properly. So then the second equation is essentially the same thing. It's just using, we just want to see how far away a subject can be if we increase the aperture by one stop. If we decrease the F number by one stop, a value of one stop. So then what our unknown was here was the 14 feet. We said that, okay, if our aperture is one stop brighter, how far away now can this subject be using this guide number? And that was 14 feet. So now, the leap that I'm asking you to make from here to here is that we don't know what the guide number is at ISO 200. But what we do know is that increasing the ISO by one stop means that it's essentially, well, just like everything in photography is give and take, if we were to make this F number the same as this this equation from up here, where we've again made it one stop darker, but what we're doing is compensating for that by increasing the sensitivity of the sensor by one stop. So now what we are saying is that these two are essentially the same thing, because rather than being at ISO 100 at F2.8, we're going to make it ISO 200 at F4.
Okay.
So essentially the exposure is the same. So sure, we get a different depth of field and we perhaps get a little bit more graininess, but the exposure values remain the same. That means that the subject can still be 14 feet away at ISO 200. However, we have to make that F number F4. And so then we can do the multiplication, 14 feet times 4, we get a guide number at ISO 200 to be 56 feet. So the important thing to realize is that camera manufacturers, or flash manufacturers more specifically, can give you guide numbers at different ISOs, but they're really only useful to compare when they are at the same ISO, because if we had a separate flash that was 56 feet at ISO 100, this is much more impressive than this flash that is 40 feet at ISO 100 or 56 feet at ISO 200. So just because these two appear to be the same, this ISO 100 means that this is actually much more powerful. It's about a stop more powerful, which means that it's twice as bright, essentially. Okay.
So
yes.
In the last example, ISO 200, you could, if you go back to F2.8, you can photograph at a longer distance.
Right, exactly. So. Right, exactly. So we can continue with this equation, and using this guide number that we've calculated, 56 at ISO 200, let's say that we now want to figure out how far we can go at F2.8. Well, now we are giving it essentially two additional stops from our original equation up here at 10 feet and F4. So we just would have to divide 56 divided by 2.8. I'm not good enough to do that in my head, and it's 20 feet. So now we've actually been able to double the distance of the subject or the object by increasing the ISO one stop and by increasing the aperture by one stop. And so just remember that this may seem confusing at first, but you have to remember this inverse square law that every time you double the amount of distance from a subject, you are essentially not having, but you're making the amount of light available one quarter that amount. So that's why it's not just this very simple halving or doubling of the distance away from the camera to represent one stop. It's actually a bit more complex than that. Okay, any other questions before we go on? Okay, so histograms. So histograms you're probably all familiar with, if maybe not with the term per se, but you've undoubtedly seen a histogram on your camera. And what it usually looks like is something like this. So this is from a future slide that I'll come back to in just a second, where we have an image, and then on your camera or maybe on your computer, you'll see a whole bunch of spikes and bars and various other things. And so the point of this lecture is to break it down and really understand what that histogram is showing us. And that may seem like we're going to get into some really crazy things, and indeed there are. There are many things about the histogram that that are useful to know and certainly will alter your perception of what it is. So first, let's just break it down very simply. What is a histogram? Anybody work with histograms, perhaps with their job or anything like that? Yes, it's a statistics, right, it's a statistics thing. Essentially all it is just the frequency of some occurrence happening. And so this is a histogram here on slide 2, and I shamelessly stole it from Wikipedia's explanation of histograms. But all it is it has for a particular value. So in this case, what this histogram is for is the heights of black cherry trees. So this could be maybe in somebody's, well, there's too many to be in a backyard, but we could say in a forest, for example. And it lists the height here along the x-axis, where we have 60 feet, 65 feet. And then for each of those values, it tells us how many trees exist for each of those values. So we can see that from 60 to 65 feet, we have about 3 trees, perhaps. From 65 to 70 feet, we have about 3 trees. 70 to 75 feet, we have 8 trees, so on and so forth. So what does this mean for us? Well, what we measure is something slightly different. What we are measuring is basically the values from black to white and their occurrence or the frequency of each of those values in a particular image. So something right at the very, very far left here would represent very true black, just the very black pixel. And this counts the number of pixels that are completely black. And we go through all of these gray tones all the way to white, where we have the very whitest pixels, so something that is completely, completely white. So we have then all of these things in the middle, these different variations of grays, all of these different tones that exist within the image. And so remember that I was mentioning that a camera tries to expose for a middle gray. And if it had its way and it was just a very blank, just very simple color, maybe all white or all black, for example, then we try to put it somewhere right in the middle, just to expose it properly. Okay, but let's take a step back and look at some histogram examples, just very, very basic, very simple histograms. So we have here a completely black image, and what we see to the right is just basically Photoshop's histogram that it shows us for this particular image. So as you can see, we have no values anywhere except completely, completely black. So we have this one black bar spiking all the way up, saying that our entire image is completely black. So similarly, for an all-white image, we have the opposite. We have nothing except all the way at the very far right, which represents white, the very brightest thing. So how might this look in an actual photograph? Well, this, again, is our pinhole camera example from the first lecture, and I just happened to copy and paste the histogram from Photoshop for this photograph, and we can see that we have a variety of gray tones in here. So obviously this picture is not in black and white, it's not in black and white, it's in color, but the histogram here is showing us right now just some gray tones, and we'll talk about how it does that conversion a little bit later. But you can think of it for right now as the computer calculating how dark or how bright every pixel is in this photograph and then showing us a representation here. So here we have, in this histogram, a fairly good tonal range. We have quite a few values, but nothing that's completely underexposed, which means that we have nothing that's completely black and nothing that's completely overexposed. So this is generally pretty good. If we were to look at the photograph on the computer and really scrutinize it, you're not losing any data at either the very low end or the very high end. The camera was able to capture all of the bits in this particular scene. And in fact, using the histogram is something that you really should get used to doing, especially when you have a digital camera and you're using it outdoors or out in the field or wherever, basically, that you are not looking at an image on the computer. Yes?
Wouldn't you want to have at least one or two pixels that are absolute black and one or two that are absolute white?
So wouldn't you want one or two pixels that are absolute black and some that are absolute white? Well, it depends on what you want out of the image and how much dynamic range or how much contrast is actually in the scene. If we were taking a photograph of something very boring, so maybe a single color, for example, then we certainly wouldn't want that because then we would be increasing the contrast far too much in that particular image. So certainly if you have a wide range of tones like this, which I'm sure is what you were referring to, you might want to increase the contrast a little bit, which will actually stretch this out, and we'll talk more about that later. But you run the risk of introducing some artifacts into the image if you do it too much. So sometimes it's better to leave it as it is. If this was a little bit wider and I just wanted to get a little bit more contrast out of it, then sure, I see no reason why not. But again, if you really wanted everything to have some value other than pure black and pure white, then you would try to compress. You would try to compress that a little bit and get something more like this. But what you're saying isn't wrong. It just depends on the situation, of course. So it's pretty complex. But we'll talk about all of these different reasons why you might want something over another. But anyway, when you're looking at an image on the back of your digital camera, you generally also want to look at the histogram as well, because this will give you a pretty good idea of whether or not your image is actually properly exposed. When you are outdoors, especially in harsh sunlight, or in any situation where you have a lot of light that's hitting your camera, it's very difficult to just look at the screen and look at the image that's on the back of the camera and try to determine if it is properly exposed or not. If you use the histogram, you can generally make a better guess, or it's not really a guess with many of the histograms, but you can at least make a better determination if you have properly exposed your image or not. And I'll show you some examples of that in just a few slides. Okay, so some more examples. So in this case, there's a lot more contrast in this scene, and this does give you an example of where you would want some black pixels. You can see that at the very far left of the histogram, we do have some black pixels. And all the way at the far right of the image, we have some white pixels. And so you can see, though, that the majority of the tones in this image, because we don't have very large spikes at either end, the majority of the tones in this image are somewhere in the middle, which is usually what you want when you are talking about photographs. So that way you make sure that every value, every color in this is not black or is not pure white. You actually get some variation in the image. Okay, let's see. So we have, again, a fairly wide tonal range, whereas in this other one, we didn't really. We had a lot of tones. We did have a lot of tones, but they were fairly compressed here, especially in this slightly darker region, which you can sort of tell as being true. Most of the shirts, for example, are slightly darker than the overall image being lighter, whereas in this one, we just have a very wide range of dark tones to light tones, everything in the middle. And the relative height of each of these bumps gives you a pretty good idea of how prevalent it is in an image. So if you have, so you can see that this is the highest bump or hill, so to speak. So we have the most values in this darker range, but we have also quite a bit of values in these other peaks as well. And we'll talk about that, of course, in just a little bit. So some more examples. Here's another image where we do have some overexposed pixels, especially in the center here, where that's really sort of unavoidable, but you can, it's noticeable. There's a bit of a spike there at the far right end. We also have some underexposed pixels where it's completely black. Most likely that's in this region over here, the upper right-hand corner, and you can tell that that's there based on this small spike in the black area. But otherwise, we have a pretty good tonal range. We have fairly good range right there. So. As you can see, every photograph will be a little bit different. There's no one correct histogram that you should try to model your photos after. So if you have a photo that has a histogram that looks like this, don't just call it a day. It may need some additional adjustments. It really depends on the photograph itself. So we have here an example of an image where we perform some intentional underexposure, and you can see that as a result of that, we have quite a few pixels that are completely black, and that's what we wanted in this case, and we can't see very many tones. There's not very many tones represented in the other tonal range areas, or just in these middle gray or these somewhat light areas, but that's okay because what we wanted to be exposed is properly exposed. And so just because we have a lot of very dark, very black pixels, it doesn't mean that the rest is completely black. So you have to take more than just especially if you have very large spike like this, it can change the relative height of the other bumps, so to speak, the other peaks in the histogram. So you can have a lot of very dark pixels here, which will flatten the rest of the histogram out a bit, tricking you essentially into thinking that you don't have enough values that are not black. So if this is what you're trying to do and you're trying to intentionally underexpose something, then you do have to take care that not only your histogram is correct, where you have a lot of truly black pixels, but also that what you want to be properly exposed is properly exposed. Similarly, for overexposure, this one worked out a little bit better, perhaps because it is more of a pure white background, and also the bottle is larger in the photograph itself, so we have a greater percentage of pixels that are not just completely, completely white, even though we can see a full spike all the way in the farthest right corner of this, or the farthest right side of this histogram. Okay, so where this histogram really starts to become useful is when you're taking a look at an image and needing to do some exposure compensation to it. So taking a look at this scene, when I was there actually looking at it, I could tell that it was going to be predominantly fairly bright because it's very snowy, and also the sky was about the same luminosity or the same brightness as the snow itself. So when I first took the photo and noticed that I had this huge peak almost right smack dab in the center, that is a big clue that this was underexposed. And certainly when I was looking at the image, my eyes played some tricks on me. When I was looking just at the image without the histogram on the camera itself, it looked okay because the scene or the light surrounding me was it was fairly dark. Even though this should be brighter, it was fairly dark. It was starting to become nighttime. And so the bright screen fooled me into thinking that I had a properly exposed image. If I hadn't actually taken a look at the histogram and noticed that it was very far to the left, then I would not have been able to correct for it and gotten the properly exposed photo and histogram that we see here, where by giving it a positive exposure compensation, you essentially are pushing all of these tonal values all the way to the right as they should be, and then you can tell when you are getting a properly exposed photograph. So it makes metering a bit more clear when you're looking at not only the image, but the histogram as well. You can get a better idea if there's any compensation that you need to do in the image. And it also tells you when you're completely messing up a photograph like this one here, where especially on the projector, and if you take a look at the handout itself, the way it was printed, it really looks quite bad. There's some sections where the shadows completely get rid of all of the detail inside of this bridge, for example, and also the light sky is so bleached, it's so white that we lose all of the detail there, even though there were clouds and some blue sky that was visible there as well. And so this makes it very easy to tell where our problem spots are. So looking at the histogram, we can see that we have far too many pixels that are both completely black and completely white, so we would have to try to basically level out this scene, and by making the light more even if we can, by maybe introducing some additional light inside of the bridge if possible, or, well, that's just about it. There's not a lot you can really do in this scene. Maybe wait a little bit for the sky to dim, and then the shadows will be less harsh, the light will be less harsh, and you can take a photo again then. Do you have a question? Oh, okay, good. So what we are looking at, so one of the things that's useful to note here and that we are going to talk about near the end of this lecture is that this dynamic range of the scene is too large for that of the camera. So when we are actually looking at this scene with our eyes, we can look everywhere and be able to see details. And that's because our eyes instantaneously adjust very, very quickly to be able to view the darker parts of this bridge, for example. And then when we look outside, they adjust slightly so that we can view the lighter area outside. However, a camera can't do this. It has a fixed amount of dynamic range that it can capture over the entire image, whereas our eyes can adjust very, very quickly as we move across, even within one scene with the same amount of light. The cameras cannot do that. And so what appears to us to be relatively easy to shoot is not actually so. And it shows up as being too wide of a histogram, so to speak, on the camera itself. But most of these histograms that we are talking about are what are called luminance histograms. All the ones that I've shown here are luminance histograms. A lot of the ones that you look at on your computer using Photoshop will be luminance histograms. But there's different types. So, yes?
There are these high dynamic range photos all over Flickr.
Yes.
Are those like two exposures that are superimposed in Photoshop?
So, yes, high dynamic range photos usually are two or more photos superimposed on each other. And we have to talk more about what dynamic range is, why it's a problem, all of this sort of thing before we can talk about how to solve it. And we will go over HDR images, as they're called, high dynamic range images, and how to create one in future software lectures. So we go over all that fun stuff, and that's really where you can get some really surreal looking images by using HDR techniques. But anyway, most of the histograms that we're looking at are luminance histograms. There are other ones that exist, but in order to figure out what luminance means versus the other types, we have to go back to the basics and talk again about bits and bytes. So remember, a bit is used by a computer to denote either a 0 or a 1. That's all a computer can store. And so a byte is 8 bits, so we can have 8 zeros, 8 ones, or any combination of 0 and 1s as long as there's 8 of them. And we talked about how Using a byte, a computer can represent different values. So when there's 8 bits in one byte, that means that we have 256 different values that a computer can store in one byte of information. And so what this means is that we can measure from the 0th value all the way to the 255th value all of the different pixels, or the frequency of all of these pixels that exist. And so this is a more accurate representation of what a histogram is. We have from each of the values 0 all the way to 255 a count of each of them. So the zero value pixels, looks like there's none of them. The one value pixel, there's maybe one or two of them. And as we go across, so maybe a third of the way, maybe at about 70 or so, a value of 70, we can see that we have a large spike here. And what this gradient here is used to represent is the different values that exist from 0 to 255. So 0 to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so on and so forth, is a range from completely black all the way to completely white. And so when we are looking at a histogram, especially a luminance histogram, this is what it is showing us. It's counting all of these values and showing us the amount that each of these values exist within the photograph. So the problem is that this does not take into account color. What we are looking at is a black and white representation of the image. So remember that we were talking earlier about JPEG. Yes, did you have a question? Oh, okay. So we were talking earlier about JPEG and how we said that each of the three primary colors, or the primary colors to a computer, which are red, green, and blue, are allowed one byte of information, or 8 bits. So this means that for each and every red, green, and blue value, we can have anywhere from 0 of the red all the way to 255, 0 to 255 for the green, 0 to 255 for the blue. You multiply all of this together, you get a lot of values that can be represented just by this 8-bit representation within a JPEG file. And so we can therefore figure out what the camera, what the computer might call different colors. So for example, cyan, which would be a combination of blue and green, would be represented perhaps by a red being a 0, the green being 255, and the blue being 255. And when the computer looks at those three values, it knows to combine full green with full blue and no red, and it will combine and make a cyan color. And so there's a variety of other colors that could be made, a whole bunch. Every color that can be made can be represented by these different values. Yes?
On my camera specification, it said that it has a 12 bits.
Mm-hmm. So some cameras can actually record more than 8 bits worth of information, especially in the sensor. But when we save that data into a JPEG file, we have to convert it down to 8 bits. So it doesn't matter how many bits your camera has, it has to make it into this 8 bits for the JPEG file type. And so this is one reason why using your camera's RAW feature is especially useful. You're not throwing away all of that data. But if we have a camera that can store perhaps 10 bits or 11 bits or more of color definition, and we save that file as a JPEG file, we have to throw away some of that data in order to fit it into this 8-bit range that we have. So we can make a variety of colors just by combining these different values. And so yellow, for example, is used by all red and all green. So we would have them to represent yellow. A triad would be 255, 255, and 0, for example. And the computer would know to combine all of those things into the color yellow. And so, we then need to figure out a way to convert this color into black and white so that this camera or your computer can go back and actually perform the count and count all of these gray values, all of these gray tones that exist from completely black to completely white, and give you a histogram that shows it. So basically what we have to do is just convert. And so what would a reasonable person do maybe to convert a color into black and white, given these values. So we have three. We have these three values. 0 to 255 for red, green, and blue, and we have to make it into one value from 0 to 255 to represent grayscale. What would be an easy thing to do?
Add them up and divide by three.
Yeah, average them. Add them up, divide by three, so that we could get very simply just the gray representation of it. So completely red, for example, would be 255 plus 0 plus 0 divided by 3, and then you get about a third, which is, what would that be? That would be about 86 or so. So you could do the same thing for green, you get the same value. The same thing for blue, and get the same value. However, when we are talking about luminance, you have to go back to the first lecture and remember that the way we perceive color is different than just this. We don't just completely average this out. And if you remember this graph, we were talking about the rod and cone cells that exist in your eyes, where the cone cells are the ones that can perceive color, the rod cells cannot. And we have different types of cone cells that exist. We have the S, the M, and the L that represent different wavelengths that stimulate these cells and are used to tell our brain that we are looking at a particular color. But the trick is that we actually have, the average person actually has many more M and L types, so these green and red type cells, than we do these S cells. It's actually somewhere in the range of like 96 to 98% of the cone cells in our eye are M and L type, whereas the remaining 2 to 4% is this S type. Okay, so I have a question then for you. So let's say we have three different rooms. Okay, they're completely dark and sealed in every way except for one thing. Each of them has one light, and the light is a different color in each of the three rooms. We have one room that has red light, completely red. We have another room that is green light, completely green. We have another room that is blue light, completely blue. So now just imagine for a minute that you're in each of these three rooms with the same intensity, brightness of each of these light bulbs. Which room would appear, not be, but which room would appear to be brighter to your eyes? Yeah, the green. And this is sort of the answer that just about everybody gives when this question is asked. And indeed, because we have so many more of these cone cells in our eye, we perceive brightness differently among different colors. So basically, what it looks like to us, if we were to just convert all of these colors to this grayscale, is that green is a lighter color than red, and red is a lighter color than blue. And we have to take this into account when we are talking about the brightness of a particular color that exists. And so there's been some pretty smart people around, and what they do is they figured out numerically what each of these different values means. So if we are going to break this down and talk about luminance, we are going to say that, okay, when we are looking at a color, how bright that color looks is made up 60%, about 60% by how green it is, 30% by how red it is, and about 11, 10% by how blue it is. So what we are talking about here is that blue, when looking at a blue light, for example, it looks much darker, even though it may be the same intensity, it looks much darker than a green or a red light. And this is the way that our eyes and our brain perceive the brightness of each of these colors. Even though the brightness may actually physically be the same, our eyes and our brain perceive it differently. And so this is what we're talking about when we are referring to luminance, is that we must take into account the color. The color information itself is important in being able to determine how bright our brain perceives that color as being. So a completely green pixel, as in the center here, looks brighter than the blue one, even though referencing the values and the brightness themselves, they're actually all equal. They all have the same intensity and the same brightness, it just appears to be different to us. Okay, So when we are talking about luminance, this is the actual equation that a computer or a camera uses when calculating the luminance of a particular color. So remember, we had those three values. They could be anywhere from 0 all the way to 255. And how do we figure out what that value is in grayscale? When we are talking about luminance, as we are in these luminance histograms, we have to actually figure out how bright that color will appear to be to a human. And so we have a couple of examples for luminosity histograms. So for example, this now is an image that's not completely black or completely white, but it's completely red. And if we just did an average of it, we would expect to see a big spike right in the middle, perhaps, of this red object, or actually all the way, so right in the middle. But what actually happens is you have to convert how bright this looks to our eyes using this luminosity function to figure out what its value should be. So if you take, remember, we have these three values. So we have 0.3 times the value of red, which is 255, plus 0.59 times the value of green, which in this case is 0 because there's no green, it's just completely red, plus 0.11 times the blue value, which is 0 again. It simplifies down to 0.3 times 255, which equals about 76. And so that is the value, the black or the gray value that the computer attributes to red when we are talking about luminosity. So that means that this is going to be about a third of the way over at 0.3 or 76, and we will see a complete spike there. And in fact, we can do this, we can generate a histogram of our own if we know all of the pixels that exist in an image, if we know what all of the pixels are in a particular image. So just very quickly, let's sort of tease this apart and think of what the histogram might look like. So just looking at it, which spikes, so we'll know that because each of these are different colors, we'll have different spikes in different locations. So which spikes would be the tallest? Right, the red, the green, and the blue, and that's because we have the most of these values, whereas the rest, they're about half the size, and so we'll see spikes that are half as tall as those. And so let's just focus now on the red. Remember that for an image that is red, or for values that are red, we will have a spike that is approximately a third of the way over, so 0.3 of the way over from the histogram. And for green, what will we see there? Where would we expect the spike to be for that? Yeah, so probably closer to two-thirds or 0.6 of the way over. So I'll just draw a histogram. Now, we could go into quite a bit more detail and figure out exactly how many pixels we have in each of these, but we don't have to do that for now. We just know that these pure red, green, and blue sections are actually twice as large as the rest, so we'll just call these the tallest ones. So we're saying that, okay, about a third of the way over, we have a tall spike for red. About a sixth of the way over, or just a little bit less, we have a tall spike for green. And what about this blue? Yep, so about a tenth, which is going to be all the way over here. All right, so now we have a couple of easy sections, white and black. What will those look like? Yep, the very edges. So realize that even though we have this crazy function, it still works for completely black and completely white, because if it's completely black, that means all of these values are 0, which means the luminance is 0. If it's completely white, it means that all of those values are 255. You can do the math yourself to convince yourself if you're not sure, but you multiply it all out and it actually is 255 there as well. So we are going to have sort of half spikes at the furthest left and the furthest right. Now we have yellow and cyan. So remember that I mentioned yellow is a combination of which two colors? Right, red and green. So if we have complete red and complete green, and we go back here, That means that we are going to have a spike about where?
80%
of clients. So it's going to be closer to 90% because we have complete red and complete green. So we add those two up, we get about 0.9. There's no blue, so we have about we have a spike that's going to be a half spike that's about 90% of the way over. That's probably a little bit off, but you get the idea. And now there's one color left, the cyan. So what is going to be, what is the combination of colors that give us cyan? Yep, green and blue. So then that means that we are going to have what? If we go back to our luminosity function, that means that we have no red in it. We have about 0.6 green and about 0.1 blue, so that gives us 70%. So we have another spike. It's going to be greater than our all green spike that's here, and so it might look something like this. All right, so if we actually take a look then at the histogram for this, you see that that is exactly what we have just generated. We have half spikes at 0, 100%, sort of 70% and 90%, and then we have these very large spikes to represent the red, the green, and the blue throughout. And so this is a very simple example using just very basic colors, but your computer does this on a much larger scale across a much wider range of tones. And you could actually do this if you wanted to for all of your pictures. You could manually calculate all of the individual colors and where it would appear to be on the histogram, but luckily we have computers to do all of that grunt work for us. Are there any questions on luminosity, this luminosity function, why we have this function? Okay. All right, so let's move on and take a look at a histogram for something a little bit different. So let's say that rather than having this box be some solid color, let's say that we have a box that has maybe red. It starts out as pure red on the left side, and then there's a gradient, so it slowly fades to white on the far right. What would we expect a luminosity histogram to look like in that case? So remember that red on a luminosity histogram would start where? Yep, so about 30%. So you know that we're going to have a spike at about a third of the way, but what's the rest of the histogram going to look like? So if it slowly fades to white, what does that mean? So it's a diagonal down, so it's perhaps a little bit trickier than that. I'm sorry?
Maybe it would be straight across.
Right, so if it was, it would be straight across all the way to white. So this would be true if we had just a very even distribution from red all the way to white. And in fact, we see something that's very, very similar to that, where we have a gradient that starts from completely red and flows all the way to completely white that looks something like that in the upper right-hand corner. And you may say, okay, well, that doesn't go straight across. It seems to dip a little bit in the middle, and that's because this gradient isn't very even. So there's a much larger portion that is completely red and completely white, and then as we migrate towards that value from red to white, we actually are decreasing the number of values that we get in between. And so it sort of dips down and then comes back up. And so you'll also notice that it looks very strangely spiky. There's a lot of spikes up and down. That's probably just an artifact of the way, because as you saw from the luminosity function, we're dealing with decimals. It's not going to be exact. It might be moved one pixel over to the left and to the right. It doesn't really matter in practice. It's the overall shape that really matters more. It's also probably the way that it generated the gradient itself. There could be some, it could have skipped over certain values and given it slightly slight posterization, which remember means that it's not completely smooth gradient. There could be some difference in it, and that would account as well for this spiky nature in this histogram. So, okay. Now let's we've talked a lot about luminosity histograms. Now let's talk about a different type. Let's say that we're going to have a histogram that only shows us the red value. So from 0 to 255, so it'll look the same, where it'll be this rectangular box where the far left represents 0 and the far right represents 255. But now instead of luminosity, we're talking about the red value itself. So for however many values or pixels that have no red in it, then we'll have a spike in the 0. For however many values we have complete red, it will be 255. So with this in mind, what would the histogram look like for this same image? I'm sorry?
A slope. I don't know if it's straight or curved, but a gradient going up.
So that was my first inclination as well, but it's not actually so. There's not a gradient, and that's because here, when we are making a gradient from red to white, remember that white includes red completely. So we are introducing, we have a complete red all the way across here. We are just introducing other colors, the blue and the green. So for our red one, we actually have a complete spike in the very far right, and that's all that we have. And indeed, if we take a look at the histogram, that's what it looks like. Okay, so how about green? I sort of gave away the answer a little bit, but what would the histogram look like for the green channel? So in this case, the channel, when I'm talking about a channel, is I'm talking about just those specific set of values. The green channel means all of the pixels that have green in them. So what would, more specifically, it includes all of the pixels, but the green channel is just the green portion, just the green value from each of those pixels. So what would it look like?
Unfortunately,
I've given away the answer, but...
it makes sense from your description.
So...
It's kind of a mirror of the luminosity one a little farther down.
Right, so because if you look at the far left here, this is only red. These pixels are only red, which means that our triad, so our red, green, blue triad is 255, 0, and 0, meaning that there's no green and there's no blue present in order to show complete red in this image. That means that we have some sections, so I'm going to get rid of this red and call it green now. We have some sections that are completely dark. There is no green whatsoever. However, when we have a gradient all the way to white, we are introducing more and more and more green. So that means that we have not only a spike at 0, but also 255. And we would expect it to be flat here, but again, because of the same problem that we have, it actually dips down a bit. So there's actually a larger section where there's no green, and that's because there's probably quite a few pixels width here where it's completely red and there's no green at all. And then there's quite a few pixels at the far right where there's a lot of green. So you can imagine then that it would look very similarly for the blue channel as well. And that's just because it's the same thing as the green. We have no blue color on the way in the far left, and then as we move to the right, we get more and more blue. Okay, so this exercise was not pointless, and this is used to show you that different histograms can show us different things that are useful in different ways, and they will all show us something slightly different, but if you know what each histogram means, then you can look at each histogram and try to make a determination about the actual values in your photograph itself. And so we can actually combine these red, green, and blue histograms into one called, we'll call it a colors histogram, where we have here a combination of the red, the green, and the blue, and it actually superimposes them on top of each other. So it looks then, when you're combining blue and green, you get cyan, remember? So it's just superimposing the red, the green, and the blue right on top of each other, and we get this cyan sort of gradient that we saw before, which means that we have these blue and the green that start from 0 and proceed all the way to their highest value at 255. And if we were able to see it, we would actually see a spike for the red channel there as well. So colors is pretty useful, and we'll talk about why it's useful compared to luminosity in just a little bit. But there is yet another type of histogram that your computer or that your camera can show you, and that is an RGB histogram. So now we've introduced three different types. We have luminosity histogram, which uses that luminosity function to tell you the distribution of values of brightness across the photograph, or how bright that photograph will appear to us. We then have the colors histogram, which is basically a superimposed version of each of the three individual color channels. And then we have this RGB, which is much more of an average of the of each of the three individual color channels. And you'll notice that because it's an average, it sort of dips down a little bit because there's zero red throughout this entire portion here. Yes? So why is there no green or blue in this image?
Why is there any green or blue in the histogram when it's all red?
Okay. So the reason that there is any green or blue at all is that in order for the computer to make the color white, it has to combine all of the colors. So it's as if it's like the colors of a rainbow, for example. In order for the sun's light to appear white to us, it has to have all of the colors present within it. It's the same idea here, where in order for the computer to produce a color that is white, it has to show red, green, and blue.
Right.
So, and in order for it to show only red, there can be no green, there can be no blue. So over in this far left section, there's no green and there's no blue, but over where it's white, we have the complete presence of red, of green, and blue in this particular portion of the image. So that's why, and because of this gradient, because we're getting progressively more and more white in this image, then we have to add more and more green and blue. So we get this, that's where all of these middle values come from, is from this addition of green and blue, introduction of green and blue as we proceed to the right of this image. On the left-hand side of the histograms, there's green and blue. Okay.
On the left-hand end, where it's all red.
So what's important to realize is that what is the left-hand side here is not the left-hand side here. Right. There's green and blue evenly across because there's zero green and zero blue here. But as we start to get more, as we start to get more and more white across this image, then we have to add more green and blue values. So we could talk about black and white, so to speak, where we have just all red and all white here. And in that case, we would only see spikes at the 0 and the 255 area in the histogram. However, because we're introducing progressively more and more and more values as we go towards the right of the image, then we see this
zero values,
right, there's zero, right. Right, numerically speaking, so that's what we're talking about. Yes?
So the green and blue the green and blue here don't account for black and white in both ways. Like the top one accounts for black and white, and the image accounts for black and white, but these red, green, and blue don't account for black and white.
What do you mean don't account for black and white?
They're just counting what is red, or what is green, or what is blue.
Right, so we are looking, so for these red, green, and blue channel luminosity, or I'm sorry, these red, green, and blue channel histograms, we are not looking at some averaging of the values. We're looking at the raw values themselves. So it's as if we used with some super magnifying glass, and actually that's a good idea. That's what I'll show. So we have here, for example, so we have this same thing, and let me just bring up a color meter that will show us the values. So right here, I basically just have a program where wherever I put my mouse, it shows me the red, the green, and the blue color values. So if I move over an area that's completely white, we see, as we know, all red, green, and blue, so 255 across the way. If I move over to something that's completely black, we then have a complete absence of values. So if we start from here, this furthest left portion, we see that we have a completely red segment of the image. So it's the red is 255, there's no green, there's no blue, because then introducing any green or any blue means that it is not pure red. It is only this one red. So as we move it...
So where your mouse is, or where your cursor is where you are measuring.
Yes, where the very tippy tip of my cursor is, that is where you can see this is a magnified version.
Okay.
Yep, it's just a magnified version of what my cursor is over. So as I start moving across, you'll notice that I've moved over quite some distance and I'm still in this pure red section. But pretty soon what's going to happen is the green and the blue values are going to start increasing, going up and up and up and up. And you can see the same thing. You can actually take a look at the color. This is a more general overview of the color that I'm over right now. You can see that it's not pure red. It's this sort of pink value, and that's because I've introduced a variety, or I've introduced green and blue values that lighten the tone. So as I keep moving across, green and blue increases all the way until I get to 255, which is pure white. And so what we are measuring in these color channels is each of these three individual values within the entirety of the image. So when we are looking at this red version, for example, we don't care about this green and this blue, this green and this blue value. We only care about the red value as it exists throughout this image. When we're looking at the green, we only care about the green one that exists throughout this image. Okay, let's take a 5-minute break. Okay, welcome back, everybody. So I wanted to take a few steps back and go back to this slide. And we actually had a pretty good question before about the relative heights of each of these bumps, or these mountains and peaks, so to speak, however you want to call them in these histograms. The question was essentially, why is the area under the histogram not the same, since the number of pixels that we have in an image never changes? Why then do we have some of these very flat-looking histograms? And the answer is that it's all very relative when we are talking about looking at a histogram. So these histograms work best when we have a distribution of tones. When we have a lot of tones and a lot of variety of tones, then you get to see very plainly the change in values between each of them. However, what can happen is if you have one tone that dominates everything else, that will cause a very large spike in the histogram. And that's where we get this very huge spike at the far left. And because this spike just keeps going up and up and up, it doesn't actually overflow, so to speak. The camera or the computer will show you all of the values that make that up. Then it flattens everything else, just because it's this relative view in the histogram. So we're pushing up all of these dark values in this image, and all of the rest just sort of gets flattened, so to speak. And if we were to actually lob that off, if we were to somehow cut off this portion of the image and just redo the calculation, you would notice that the histogram then pops back up. So whereas it looks sort of flat like this here, if we were able to remove that very far left portion, we would get something that much more closely resembles this normal distribution with these peaks and valleys that we come to expect from a histogram. So one of the things that I thought would be interesting would be to actually bring up this image that we were talking about in previous slides in Photoshop. So I'll move this color meter out of the way. Many of the things that we can see are not only the histogram, so this is the live histogram as it's shown in Photoshop. And in this case, it doesn't actually very nicely color the blue, the green, and the red portion, but it's exactly the same. We have nothing in the red except all the way at this far right, basically just total red everywhere in the image, and the same thing that we talked about earlier with the green and the blue as well. However, we do have a section in Photoshop called channels. And remember that I discussed each of the individual color channels that exist, and what each channel means is one of the three values from this triad that whose combination gives us color. So if we were to take a look at red, we see what we expect. So remember, what it's doing is it's taking only this red channel, so only this, all of the values that make up the red itself, and showing us what that is. And remember that because everything, everywhere in this photo or in this image is red, we see all white because it's completely 255. The value is 255 everywhere. Now, if we were to take a look at the green channel, for example, what we see is that there is a complete absence of green. That's why it's black here. There's a complete absence of green. And then slowly, as we saw using this color meter, we start to get more and more and more and more green until eventually we get to this white portion over here. And the same thing with blue. So each of these individual color channels then represent, or can be represented by each of these color channel histograms that we've shown in some of the slides and as are shown here. And there's actually some really interesting things that you can do with histograms. Well, maybe not interesting, but fun and geeky. And in fact, one of the things that somebody did was try to make an image out of a histogram. And so it's very postmodern sort of idea here. But basically what happens is that there's this image that appears to be a gradient from black to white, although there is actually some variation in each of the different values that exist. And if you bring it into Photoshop and take a look at the histogram, what you see then is a New York skyline. And remember that the reason that this can happen is that, well, here, you can't lose sight of what a histogram is. This very far left area is completely black, so there's so much completely black, and then there's a little bit more as it gets grayer, and then less, and then more and less, and so on and so forth, to make this skyline, this New York skyline. And in fact, I'll post a link to this on the course website later, but he even managed to make an image that is its own histogram. So we have an image here that actually has its own histogram here as well. And so it's all pretty fun, geeky stuff, and not very useful for us, but it will help you at least maybe understand a little bit better what the histogram is and why it is doing what it is doing. Okay.
So in the New York City skyline one, the person who created it had to say, okay, this is...
Right, so the person who created it... Right, so if he were to do it manually, which I don't think he did, but if he were to do it manually, then what he would have to figure out is that, okay, for this tallest spike here, which actually looks like it's an antenna on one of the World Trade Center buildings, this is, you know, about 90%, so that means that the value is maybe, you know, 235. So that means that I have to have the most 235 value in this image, and if you were to take a look at it and actually count the pixels that make it up, then that would certainly be the case. And so it's just this progression. You'll notice it's perhaps harder to look, especially if you're sitting farther back, but if you're looking at the image on your computer, you notice that it's a gradient, but different gray values exist in different quantities. So for example, we have quite a bit of black, for example, quite a bit of pure black, and then there's quite a few of this sort of darker gray. But then there's not a lot until sort of this lighter area, and so you can sort of tell, you can't see the image itself because of how the histogram is calculated, but you can tell how this image could be generated based on the frequency of each of these values within the image itself. So it's certainly a pretty fun thing to take a look at. Okay, so why am I torturing you with all of this information? Now, it actually is very, very useful to us as photographers. And so taking a look at an image like this here, we can see that there's not actually a lot of variation. There's not a lot of variation in the histogram. Some look wider than others. Some are more squished than others. But overall, they look relatively the same. However, where we start to see differences in each of these histograms is when we really start to push things to their limits. So this image, for example, we have a lot of really harsh values, a lot of really bright green areas, a lot of really bright red values, and a lot of really bright blue values. And in fact, it's predominantly blue. But taking a look at different histograms for this image shows us a very different tale. So, for example, if we were to first take a look at the luminosity, we can see spikes in each of the three sections that we expect to see for the red, the green, and the blue, because that is predominantly red, it's predominantly green, and it's predominantly blue. And so we see, just like we would expect for a luminosity, luminosity histogram, big spikes at about 10%, 30%, and 60% of the way in order to make this histogram. However, what it doesn't show you in this luminosity histogram is that we are actually getting what's called clipping. And so clipping is another term for basically overexposing some section of the image. So not only can you overexpose an image in terms of how white it is, so if you were taking a photograph of a very backlit sky, for example, or you're taking a photograph of a person that is very backlit with a very bright sky behind them, you take that photograph and the sky, the background, would look very white. You would lose all of the details behind that person. However, you can also lose detail by making one color channel too bright. And that all of these things are all examples of clipping, where you get so much data, so much information that the camera can't actually process it, so to speak, or it's too much for it. And so it becomes too bright, and then it can't represent values beyond this brightest 255 value. So we get this clipping that happens. And so here, for example, if you were to take a look at it, you can see that we have these gradients that happen from this deep blue to this bright green, for example. But you can tell that there's a section where there's no more of a gradient. It's only this pure bright green, and that's the section where clipping is occurring. We're getting no additional details here. So this is something that you would obviously not encounter in real life, but it is a good example of what can happen when looking at different histograms. So looking at an RGB histogram here, for example, we can see that we do actually get some pretty strong clipping, or we're overexposing some channels in the camera. We're going to probably lose some data in each of these color channels, or at least one of these color channels. We can see that in the RGB histogram, whereas if you were taking a look at the luminosity histogram, it's not exactly apparent. Now, this image is not very bright because there's not a lot of white in it. It's only pure color, and so a luminosity histogram won't show us a lot of very bright area that exists within it. So this is the difference between these two, where the luminosity histogram will show us how bright it looks to our eyes. That's not the whole story, and you can lose data if you're not careful, and that's when these other histograms come into play. So to take a look at a more real-world example, let's say, for example, we are taking a photograph of just a garden, for example, or something where you have some flowers that are very brightly colored. So if we were to take a look at the luminosity histogram, overall it looks relatively dark. There's a lot of somewhat dark areas, and that's probably because of the trees, and just overall it's very red, so there's not a lot of very bright areas within it. But what that doesn't show you is that if you were to take a look at the red channel histogram itself, by itself, you'll notice that you have a nice even distribution of red tones within the photo, but you actually are getting this very large spike or this large blip that exists in the far right section, which means that in the red channel you have some values that are completely bright, so completely 255 in this red channel. And what this means is that you are losing detail within the flowers, within the petals themselves. And so you can even see it here, and let's see if I can try to explain it. But so it looks pretty good. It doesn't look like you're losing a lot of data, but where you're losing data are on these very bright portions of the petals. So before all of these, so in these darker regions on the petals here, for example, you're getting detail. You're seeing the folds in the petals, and you're seeing detail where there's some contrast between one petal and another. But when it's completely red here, you're losing detail and data that exists within that petal. So maybe there's a fold in that petal that's so brightly lit, the camera can't actually see it. And so in this case, looking just at a luminosity histogram isn't going to tell you everything about this photo. You are losing data, even though you're just looking at the luminosity histogram, and it just really doesn't look like it. You would have no idea just by taking a look at it. So you'd either have to be able to spot the fact that you are losing data in some of these very brightly red regions, or you would have to take a look at some of these individual color channels. And so where I got this image from, they're saying that there's not really a lot of apparent clipping in the RGB section, But it you can tell that there's a small spike. And so even if your camera doesn't have a red channel histogram, which many of ours don't, usually you will have either RGB or luminosity, and you can tell, especially if you have an RGB, if you're just making it too bright for one of the color channels. And so where this isn't useful, though, is to be able to tell the luminosity or the brightness of the image itself. And so in this way, especially in scenes such as this, where you have some very brightly lit colors, it's very easy to blow out, so-called blow out the details, where you lose some of the detail in some very brightly colored regions because they are the color is too strong for the camera to be able to record it. So the difference here, again, is that the luminosity, the brightness of this appears to be fine, but where you're losing data is arguably the most important section, where you want it in these flowers themselves. You are losing some of the detail that exists within the flower. And every time people take photos of flowers or of their garden, this is one of the most apparent problems that exists. It's because people really love the really strong colors that can come out of a scene like this, but you can also lose a lot of the detail because your camera just simply cannot capture it.
How can you fix this? It doesn't look like you want to reduce the exposure.
So how can you fix this? Well, there are a couple of ways. So you could try to decrease the exposure. You could try to do a high dynamic range scene where you take multiple exposures at different values, and then you later on mash them all together and be able to retrieve that data. One thing, people simply accept this and just say, okay, well, it's going to be lost. That data is going to be lost, but that's usually not a good thing to do. Another way could be to use a filter. So maybe you could use a green filter, for example, to filter out some of the harsh red light that's coming in and even out the tone slightly. You would lose the pop, some of the pop from this, from these red flowers, but you could later in software go back and increase the contrast, perhaps, or the brightness in the red channel and regain some of the pop that you have lost by using a filter. So the cheapest way to do it would be to do it in software, where you take multiple exposures of it, where you try to underexpose it as much as possible, while getting, not as much as possible, but you want to underexpose it so that you can get all of the details from the flowers in them, and then later on go back and just selectively increase the brightness on certain channels so that you don't lose data on these very bright red channels.
Could you get an
I'm sorry?
Could you get an external glass, a green glass filter for your camera?
Yes, so they do have different filters that can attach to the lens of your camera. And so as a reminder from the optics lecture, all of these lenses actually tell us the size of the filter that they can accept. And so you can go to a store like B&H or a variety of stores and just look for a color filter that you can attach to the front. Usually they're a little expensive for what we want to do, especially because they make the argument that being optical filters, they have to be very expensive so that they're very even, the green is very even, and that they don't alter any other color channels, for example, or that they only alter other channels besides green. So they can be expensive. So that's why I make the argument for doing it in software later. It takes a little bit more time, perhaps, but it will save you a lot of money as well. But if you take a lot of photographs like this, then usually going the optical route and buying the proper filters would be the better way to go, because then at that point you're getting more bang for your buck, so to speak. But yes, so to answer your question, which I'm sure was not meant to make me go off on a tangent, yes, you can buy filters like that. They do have a variety of systems even. So there are some systems, let's see, I believe one of them, I haven't worked with it in so long, I think it's called a Kokin or a Konkin system, maybe some of you more familiar can remind me, where you attach an adapter basically to your lens, and then you are given these rectangular filters that are plastic, but they fit in to this adapter in front of your lens, and then you get different color filters, and it's actually relatively cheap using one of these types of filters, because they're not specially made, and so you get this sort of decrease in quality as a result, but also it's much better value. So there are a variety of options that exist. Okay, so this brings back this idea where our cameras only have a certain range of values that it can accurately capture. So there's some values, there's some amount of light that's too much for the camera, and there's some amount of light that's too little. Beyond each of these limits, where your camera just will not be able to capture detail or data, and you will lose that data when looking at the image itself. And so this happens not only in scenes with black and white or darker regions and brighter regions, but even within individual color channels. And so how does the camera know what black is and what white is? And so it's with the camera, it's relatively easy to figure this out. It can only measure, it has a minimum amount of photons that hit the sensor, and the sensor will therefore be able to figure out that that is some certain value. And there's a maximum amount beyond which the camera will say, okay, it's too bright, it's only this pure white that we are looking at. But, and where this, where this really starts to trick us is when we introduce our eyes and our brains into the picture, because what we look, when we look at a scene and when we perceive that scene, it's a lot different than how a camera will be able to do it. A camera is very linear. It's very, has a very measured response to it, but it, this can be very confusing to us because we are looking at a scene and it looks fine to us no matter where we look. And so this is just one example where this scene tricked my eye, where I was looking at this darker region in the shadows here, and I was able to see detail. I looked in the brighter region, and I was able to see detail. I was able to see clouds and blue sky. But when you actually take the photograph, it's obvious that the camera is unable to perceive these differences in contrast. And so the eye really makes things somewhat tricky for us. So this is just a copy of a slide from earlier, and you don't have to remember all of this stuff. It's just used as an example. But the eye really makes things, really makes photography difficult to us, because there's never this notion of true black and true white. It's all very, very relative. So what our eyes perceive as being white may not actually be truly white. And this comes into, you may ask what I mean by that. I'm talking both about in terms of color and in terms of brightness. Our eyes adjust, and our brains use visual context, visual stimuli, to try to figure out what should be white and what should be black in a scene, and it will adjust settings in our brain, so to speak, if you want to think of it that way, so that it actually appears to be that. However, that's not the way that cameras work. And so, just as an example, remember that when we're talking about stops of light, we're talking about doubling or halving the amount of light that can exist. And so our eyes can actually perceive differences of about 1 billion or so to 1. And this not necessarily instantaneously, but if we go from a very dark room all the way to the brightest, bright of days, and our eyes readjust, the differences in the amount of photons hitting our eyes is about a billion or so photons versus just a few that we can see in very dark regions. And so this is actually about 30 stops of difference. So our eyes can perceive about 30 stops of light after giving some time to adjust for them. So, however, our instantaneous, so the time that, so rather than allowing our eyes time to adjust, let's say we're stuck in this room and our eyes are darting about, the screen is a bit brighter than, for example, your hand would be, especially if it's in the shadows. The instantaneous dynamic range, or the difference that your eyes can perceive instantaneously, is actually much less. It's about 10,000 to 1, or about 13 stops. And this is on a very, very bright day. So right now it's probably a little bit more. And actually, when the light goes down, as the light gets dimmer, you can actually perceive a greater variety, a greater change in the amount of brightness in the room. So if we were to turn off all the lights and we were to become night adjusted, we could actually perceive contrasts of maybe 20 stops or so, or about 1,000,000 to 1, rather than in a very bright day where we can only perceive about 13 stops of difference. And so this same sort of thing happens in a camera. There's a minimum amount. There's a minimum amount of light that must be sent to the camera sensor in order for it to detect the light and be able to call it a value. And there's a maximum amount of light beyond which the camera says, okay, it's only pure white. I can't process any more than this. However, that dynamic range, this range of values, is much less in a camera than it is for our eyes. And when we talk about dynamic range, you can think of it basically as being a bucket. So what we're doing is we have a lot of pixels within the camera that are buckets that are collecting photons. And if you want to think of it like rain dripping into these buckets, then you certainly can. It's a pretty good analogy, actually, for what we are talking about. And so in order for us, in order for the camera or this pixel to be able to determine how much light is entered in, usually there's a minimum amount of water that's dripped in here, or a minimum amount of photons that must drip in here for the camera to register it as being something other than completely black. So there's this range, the dynamic range, of light that can enter into the sensor and pixel, and it can be registered as some color tone, as some black to white value, for example. So, just imagine what happens if we put too much light into this bucket. What would happen if we put too much rain into this bucket? It overflows, and we can't measure anything beyond that. And it's exactly the same sort of idea here. So if you were measuring, if you want to think of it like you are measuring how much rain is falling across the United States, for example, and you have a lot of buckets. I'm just going to use this as an analogy for what can happen in a camera. So I'm going to draw a very bad representation of the United States. We have Michigan and Maine, Texas, and this is terrible. So imagine that we have many, many buckets that are evenly spaced throughout the United States, and what we're doing is we're just measuring the amount of rain that falls everywhere in the United States. Now, there's some places where we might get so little rain, maybe just a couple of drops, that we basically can't measure that amount of rain. We'll call that amount zero. Then there's some places where we'll just be getting so much rain that it's going to overflow our buckets, and we're not going to be able to know how much rain we've actually collected. We only know that we've completely filled the bucket. And that's the same sort of idea that happens on a much smaller scale in the sensor. Across the entire sensor, we have to have a minimum amount of photons that enter into this bucket in order for us to register it, and a maximum amount beyond which the camera will only say it's completely, completely white. And so now let's imagine that we have a lot of these pixels that are actually very close together. And let's go back to our bucket analogy. What happens if you are dripping a lot of water into one bucket, and then all of a sudden it overflows, and there's a lot of nearby buckets as well? What happens to these other buckets? Yeah, they start getting filled up. And this actually occurs on a technical level as well, and it's called bluing. So if you have regions within your photograph that are very, very, very bright, it can actually cause electrons or photons to spill over, so to speak, and it's not exactly what happens, but it's a good analogy for what happens. It can actually spill over, and you can start getting abnormally bright sections really nearby as well. Yes?
So does this mean that cameras with a bigger sensor for a given number of megapixels would have a better dynamic range?
Does this mean that can you repeat that? That a camera with a given number of pixels? Yes.
But one crams 10 megapixels in it, and one only has 6 megapixels in it. Does that mean the 6 megapixels camera has a better dynamic range because the buckets are bigger?
Not very good. So yes, actually, if we have two sensors where everything else is the same, everything is the same, they're the same size, everything, the same technology, but one has fewer megapixels than the other, then there are other factors that go into this. But yes, the one with fewer megapixels will actually have a greater dynamic range. They actually have the capability to have a higher dynamic range. And this is one of the many reasons why an increase in megapixels isn't necessarily better. And luckily, we have a lot of technology that counters this problem that happens. And we'll talk about this when we start diving into digital cameras. But yes, that is a very, very good point. So So back to this idea, we have this idea of blooming that can exist when a bucket can spill over into a neighboring bucket, for example. And this happens especially frequently with very, very small pixeled cameras, or cameras that have very, very large megapixels or high number of pixels crammed into a very small area. You're more likely to get blooming than you are from a lower megapixel camera, though there's the age of the technology also plays a factor. And so basically the less light you have in this bucket, the higher the error is going to be. So just like if you have very, very low amounts of water flowing into a rain bucket that you're trying to measure, it's going to be harder to measure these smaller amounts of rain than it is to measure these larger amounts of rain. And the same sort of thing happens. And so the dynamic range then of a sensor is pretty simple. It's the largest amount of signal that it can capture, or how many photons essentially will make it be registered as a full bucket, so to speak, divided by the smallest detectable signal. So whereas, remember before I was mentioning that our eyes can actually measure a difference of about 1 million to one photons, and that's the same sort of idea, where if we are in a very, very dark room, for example, our eyes can actually measure one photon worth of light, but it can also measure about 1 million photons worth of light. And it's the same sort of idea happens here. It's so many photons over so many photons, and that gives us basically the dynamic range of that. And we'll talk more about what this means in future lectures. So what happens then is that we have some scenes that have a dynamic range that is very, very large, where we have very low amounts of photons that are coming from this area, from this darker region of the image, and we have a lot of photons that are coming from this brighter region. And the amount of photons here, when after it enters the lens and passes through the shutter and the aperture, they've been reduced so much that essentially the camera cannot register them as being some amount of detail or some values that have come into the camera. And likewise, we have too much data coming in, too many photons coming in from this brightest region, so the camera can't actually differentiate. And so what happens to our histograms is that we get this very, very wide-looking histogram, and we can tell that we have exceeded the dynamic range of our camera when we have scenes like this. And actually, many digital cameras, so SLRs tend to have a much better dynamic range than compact cameras. And usually, modern digital SLRs can handle about 10, maybe 11 or 12 stops of dynamic range, whereas compact cameras are probably more in the 5, 6, 7 stop range. So that means that a compact camera is going to have a much harder time capturing all of this available light than an SLR would. So older cameras as well, older SLRs will have less dynamic range to work with. And there's a lot more complexity that can go into this dynamic range and the relationship between dynamic range and contrast and tonal range and a variety of other things. But this is basically just an overview of what dynamic range is and why it's important. And when I think a few lectures from now, when we talk about, we'll talk a little bit about some software stuff next week, but when we come back after spring break and talk about digital cameras, we're actually going to really dive into this stuff and figure out why it's important and what this actually means for us as photographers. So that's it for today. Thank you all for coming. And don't forget, assignment 2 is due next week.